Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Mr. Lipkowski.
Hope you're not nursing hangovers from last night. We're here to talk about visualizing particular kinds of systems. We've put an image up here that sort of represents an old way of visualizing data, but I think you're all pretty familiar with it. And this is relevant to our discussion because one of the things we're concerned about is visualizing the systems that feed into global warming. We've all seen weather maps, and weather maps have become increasingly sophisticated. You can't imagine how mind-bogglingly simple they were back in the 50s and so, and when you would watch weather on television, but now you see these increasingly sophisticated 3D displays. All data is pretty much digital now, and everything can be represented as data. And we have increasingly sophisticated tools and capabilities for data visualization. We're beginning to understand sustainability as a problem that is represented as data and look at very complex data sets. And actually, one of our panelists, Plenty Fisk, will talk about that. Plenty has really turned me on to the true complexity of the kinds of data that you have to look at to understand how to get balance and how to get to zero impact. The ecological footprint, you're all probably familiar with. Who all has kind of done your ecological footprint? You've looked at it. So you know that gives you a sort of visual representation of your environmental impact. It's very simple-minded, but at the same time, it gives you something to work with, and it gives you a sense of what we're talking about. So we want to discuss what happens as we get more and more sophisticated sets of data, more and more sophisticated algorithms for analysis of that data, more sophisticated environments for data visualization, and you know, you're seeing that every day, you're seeing some new thing that makes it more and more sophisticated what you can do online, on computers, visually. And we couple that with an urgency about some very real problems that we have now. For instance, the problem of global warming. And if you heard Bill McKibben speak, you know that that's a very urgent problem. We don't really have a lot of time to solve it. So any kind of feedback mechanism that makes it easier for us to put our heads around it would be helpful there. Also, there's just increasing resource needs globally as developing nations become developed nations. So our panelists here will discuss various aspects of the visualization of the kind of data that feeds into sustainability. And we're going to start with Don Danby. We're going to give some brief intros, beginning with Don. And then Plenty's going to go through some slides, and we'll have a conversation and do Q&A afterwards. Don?
Right on. Hi, folks. Can you hear me? So my name is Don Danby. I'm a designer primarily focused on sustainability, and I've worked in a lot of different scales. I'm kind of interdisciplinary, so I've looked at urban design and designing bridges and objects and, more recently, food systems. And fundamentally, when we design stuff, we really need to be able to visualize them and see them before we make them. It's a really big part of, certainly when you're looking at trying to embed sustainable systems into things, when you're looking at the whole life cycle of objects or systems, you want to be able to see it and communicate it. The other thing is that being able to see impacts really changes the way that we use things. So we will be talking a lot about trying to make visible things that are invisible. The sustainability is, a lot of the time, really a lot of complex information. And in fact, it's when we're looking at things like, when we talk about sustainability, you end up talking about things like the carbon cycle and pollen and where birds are moving across the land and all sorts of really complex systems. And it can be really overwhelming. It can really blow people's minds a bit. So there's some really great resources out there for mapping complex systems, but pardon me? No, these aren't. I don't have any slides. I'm just talking to you. We'll get some slides.
We're having a slide-free moment.
Yeah, just zooming through stuff. The challenge is a lot of these mapping systems, a lot of the things that we see, actually don't show visualizing sustainability. They show us how to see unsustainability, right? They show us carbon impacts. They show us a lot of really difficult, challenging things. And so what I'm really interested in is figuring out how to pull threads out of those maps, out of these big data sets, to show things that don't really freak people out, you know? And part of that is in really looking at personal feedback, so that when you're designing things for people to use, the Prius is sort of the key example of you're using a car and the car is telling you what your impact is. And so there's a direct correlation. And there's many, many examples of this stuff. Actually, rather than going through examples, I'd point you to Dan Hill of City of Sound, because I've been collecting this stuff for a long time, and he's just dusted me with his delicious feeds. So Dan Hill of City of Sound for really great feedback systems. And why don't we move on?
Okay. Joel, you want to turn your slides on? Here's some slides.
I'm Joel Greenberg. I am a research director of a new research company called SciVester, and my areas of interest are virtual worlds and the future of energy. And I want to start with the recent past, about 6-7 years ago. This is the first generation iPod. How many people bought the first generation iPod when it came out? Okay. Did you have? And how many of you had like another handheld device before that? Oh, so you guys are pretty much early adopters. Here's my premise. My premise is that what the iPod did for our culture is give people the expectation that they could hold all their stuff in their hands. You know, first their whole record collection in their hand, and then all their connections to their people, all their digital data, everything in their hands. And that helped kind of solve a chicken and egg problem that you know, was a positive feedback loop into the proliferation of all the handheld devices that we're seeing today and we're gonna see more of, including this OLED wristwatch that you'll be able to buy soon there on the right. So the technology influenced, the adoption of the technology influenced our behavior, I think, as a culture. Well, and we did not talk about this beforehand, but the Prius, I think, is going to have a similar cultural significance in its behavior. You know, it's kind of like becoming the iPod of automotive, although I'm sure you'll see other cool stuff in this discussion that will be more like that. But really the big issue is that how many people have not seen the interior of a Prius? Okay, so this may be new to you. This is the dashboard feedback system, and I think the real significance there is that the gives you the instantaneous mile per gallon. And so if you talk to any new Prius, how many Prius owners do we have here? Okay, you may have this experience that a lot of people have, and you can tell your friends actually if it's true. A lot of people buy a Prius, they drive it for a week, and they are bummed out of their mind because all they can get is 35 miles to the gallon, which is the same as other hybrids and maybe even some diesels. And the reason they only get 35 miles to the gallon is because they're driving it the same way they've driven every other car. And for a century, we have driven our cars optimized for speed and or time, which ultimately is the same thing. This is really the first time in a mass way that we have a feedback mechanism to optimize driving on something other than speed and time, and that is fuel efficiency. So the feedback is the thing that changes the behavior, and the Prius gives it to us, and other vehicles give it to us, and will give it to us in the future, but we now make visible that which has been invisible. Prior to this, really the only way to get fuel efficiency is to buy a fuel-efficient car and keep it maintained, and in addition, you could track your mileage between gas, between fill-ups, but someone else drives the car, that's not real efficient. The time lag, the feedback is really long, so people, you had to be really motivated to do that. With feedback, we're going to see more and more. So a virtual world, because we're going to talk about feedback mechanisms using virtual worlds and other things, let's start with the definition. In my mind, a virtual world is an online environment that's got this game-like immersion but basically it's a social place. And really the key element is it does not have game-like goals baked into the DNA of the game. You bring the goals, your goals into it. And really at its heart is the sense of presence with other people. This does not mean it has to be 3D. It could be 2D. With this definition, you could stretch it to Instant Messenger and Twitter. I don't, but it's the idea of presence. And then where we're headed with all this, I think, well, we're going to be talking about dashboards and widgets and all this way to visualize the data, but we're going to see real-world sensors in buildings giving off data, this whole exhaust of data, that we then can use for simulations in virtual worlds and all other forms of stuff that we're going to talk about. But once you've got the data, and it's a continuous form of data, you can simulate. You can aggregate and you can talk about it in a virtual world and see it in a way that we're only starting to do right now. So we'll be talking more about visualization, simulation, aggregation, and discussion. And that's it for me.
Jume Cascio.
Hi, folks. Hi, I'm Jume Cascio. I was co-founder of worldchanging.com. But another point of relevance here is that I was the lead author on the Metaverse Roadmap Overview, which was an effort over the course of the last year and a half or so to develop a sense of where things are going in the development of 3D immersive technologies, network and communication technologies. So I want to give you a little bit of a context for the kinds of things we're talking about today. The first, with the Metaverse Roadmap, and by the way, I have no slides. I'm a believer in the maxim that power corrupts and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely.
That was keynote.
Sure, it was. And please forgive, I'm just getting over this nasty cold that everyone seems to have. The development of immersive technology that give us an opportunity to visualize the world around us. It's following four very interesting paths. These paths are driven by some fairly powerful drivers. The first is the tension between augmentation technologies, technologies that really help us to expand our sensory inputs, and simulation technologies, that is, technologies that give us the opportunity to create new worlds. The other key driver here is the tension between externally focused technologies, that is, technologies that really give us the opportunity to look out at what's happening around us, at the environment, and not just in the biosphere sense, but really at the larger locational sense of just where you are. And the tension between that and the intimate technologies that really give us the capacity to reimagine ourselves. The four different manifestations that we came up with for the Metaverse Roadmap, which can then be played out here, were the augmented reality technologies. These augmentation externally focused systems that allow you to, in essence, see a new layer on the world around you, and to be able to look out and see little Google arrows over people's heads if you want to identify who they are, or see a pathway so you can know just like from a map, a Google map, to see where you need to go, or to look out and see information about the world itself, pollen counts and weather predictions and carbon levels and the overall health and history of a particular region or particular biosphere. The augmentation technologies, when turned inward, gives us life logging. And so that typically manifests as a way of recording one's own activities, the information about one's own life, the proliferation of Twitter feeds from South by Southwest is one very narrow manifestation of life logging. The concept here is that you have the capacity to record information about your own footprints, and as these technologies become more sophisticated, give you a better means to analyze your own footprints. That intimacy turns into a new form of reality when you combine it with simulation. So the virtual worlds that we talked about a moment ago are really one manifestation of the metaverse that gives us an opportunity to experiment with new ways of being, experiment with new realities. Now, we see this happening with Second Life and World of Warcraft and, you know, Habbo and all of these different interesting immersive spaces, but all of these are fairly either generic or really goal-oriented. You know, we can go out and we can, you know, raid, do a raid on the dragons tonight if we all want. And that's wonderful, but that doesn't really help us in terms of figuring out our sustainability footprints. But imagine that kind of technology applied to the ability to create new visions of a sustainable world. And lastly, you know, the last manifestation is that combination of external focus and simulation with mirror worlds, where I think probably the canonical example would be Google Earth. You know, this system that gives you an overview, you know, a deity-like overview of what's happening on the planet. And right now, there's a bit of lag between the, you know, satellite photos and what gets updated in the software and what people can do with terms of adding layers to that to see things like, well, so one of my favorite examples is Nature, you know, one of the biggest and most important science journals. About a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, constructed a Google Earth overlay that would show you the progress of H5N1 avian flu. So you could see in a dynamic way just how this particular emerging pandemic was flowing. You can see similar kinds of uses of Google Earth to map out things like ice flows at the North Pole or changes to forestation. All of these different indicators about what's happening to the planet. With the mirror world model, with that external simulation, it's really a tool for understanding. So you have these four different manifestations of how we can use these tools to better understand ourselves, our impacts, and the world. So what do we do with these? Well, in some cases we turn them into games, in some cases we turn these into educational tools. But really, I think the interesting thing is when we start looking at them as a way of representing reality, as a way of articulating our understanding of the world, as a way of revealing not just the invisible flows, but our own tacit knowledge of how the world works. You know, one of the most important things we can do is reveal the subtle interconnections between different drivers and different flows and different processes in our lives in order to make better choices about what we ultimately do. And that's really, in the end, what all of these tools that we'll be talking about today are about, making smarter, better choices.
Thanks, Mike. Plenty Fisk is the fearless leader from the Center for Maximum Potential Building Systems here in Austin, and is an authority on building systems, especially green building systems. Plenty.
So I'm going to combine who I am with the presentation, but I want to mention one sort of very general thing. Over many years, I used to come to any workshop like this, and I'd have people take their hands and show me their hands. And I would say right away I knew who the bullshitters were, because those who really work, you can tell by their hands. I've had to change that over the years, because when Bill Mollison came along in the permaculture movement, he introduced an extremely important word, and that was WorkNet. Not network, but WorkNet. WorkNet, from a conceptual sense, basically says, who are all those people that have to work together to pull off what we're about to try to do and have to do? And that is represented in many different ways. And when I came up with this topic idea for the panel of envisioning sustainability, I began to think of all the different things that I've been involved with for the last 30 plus years in what that means. And I think one of the classic ones is when I went to Curitiba, Brazil, one of the really good places for carrying out these kinds of things as a city. And Jamie Lerner brought me to a neighborhood, and he says, go and look at that light tower over there and see what you think. I said, well, I can barely read it, but I'll go over and I'll look. And what was going on is that neighborhoods had light towers, and the light towers were indicators to that region and part of the city as to how well they were doing that day in saving forests, in recycling, in saving mining, in saving energy, and so on. And it would be displayed as a feedback tool, just the way it was being discussed a moment ago. So I'm very used to things that are quite tactile, that do this stuff in very plain, straightforward ways. But then I got very excited about a wild thing that I saw on the New York Times. In fact, I was at dinner with the mayor at a conference, and I got so excited about it that I said to Will Wynn, you know, maybe we could make really the whole area of Austin that is green visible. How do you do that? So the article was essentially one of the many things that have been presented so far that was really the cell phone, as Stuart Brandt used to say, as the technique of introducing the Swiss Army knife of our future. So I'm going to go through in this presentation some experiences and what we've done to just give a sort of outlay. They're not all very visual. We do as an organization four levels of things. We build things. That's very important feedback. We do master planning. And that master planning is at all kinds of different scales and levels. We're doing a community of 50,000 people in San Antonio at the moment. We do a lot of policy work with cities, states, nationally. The co-director to our center, Gail Vittori, is the chairperson for the U.S. Green Building Council nationally. So there's a lot of policy that goes on. Then we develop tools. And some of these tools I'm going to talk very briefly about that are very, very robust, extremely complex in their depth tools. But we've also tried, in our own weird way, to get into the whole gaming concept, because we find that communities being introduced to what does sustain mean is very seldom understood. So the WorkNet I've mentioned, Visible Green is trying to support that WorkNet. The idea that WorkNets are really cycles of things. There's cycles of water, cycles of air, cycles of materials, food, etc. We feel can be tagged within all the incredible things going on in Austin and our region, that we can actually give tags to those things and begin to identify at all sorts of scales how these are working, and that actors in the field, homeowners, business owners, and so on, actually can have this tagging going on with them. So we have played with this on a conceptual basis, and this was my conclusion, so I thought that since these guys are going to cut me off, that I'd start with my conclusion and then work as to why the conclusion is the conclusion. So we've been also getting into what we call virtual city gates. When you enter a city, what are you being introduced to? How does that cell phone connect to a whole series of things within that city? If people don't know about it, this is going on, put it in Google. There is a tremendous amount of work going on in that field, and these guys know a whole lot more about it than I do. So is the city a game? There's a great little book coming out of Europe called Game Zone that really is extremely provocative as to where the city and the world might be going as to what is a game and what isn't. We're sitting in one great big game every day, perhaps. And this idea of working through to get to this mimetic world, this biophilic world, this world that relates at a next level from where we are, and how do we virtually pull that together and pull that off in a staged manner. The Austin Green Builder Program, interestingly enough, and this was the diagram that won the actual Earth Summit Award, it was in that booklet, where Austin in 92 was the only operation or any entity in the United States that won an award. But the award was based on a feedback loop. In other words, how was the life cycle of sourcing and all the way through to use and resourcing working? Was there a monitoring technique? Were there commissions in our city that actually related to that monitoring? Did the commission go to the city council and said something has to change in this area, feed that out to the private sector and come back and tell us? So this idea of a life cycle became a framework, and that framework became people, became businesses. The businesses overlapped in many, many ways with each other until you have thousands and thousands of these businesses working together. So every time we did a building, we became very conscious that we were organizing networks, really organizing the region to emphasize certain kinds of things versus others, the more sustainable things. Our own facility, which is a state demonstration facility that if any of you want, we have usually cocktail hour on Fridays, if you're still around, out at our center. And there are many people that gather in that place of wide variety of types. Businesses have started there, many things. But that building tracks itself to the people that created it, the resources that it was based on, and how that connects to the region or the State Farm. Where did we borrow that information from before the web even existed back in the early, well, it was actually before that, but before we had access to this kind of thing, we made believe that this sort of worldwide network of knowledge existed to produce a farm sensibly in our part of the world. As we get into our county, we begin to realize we can organize businesses related to these cycles, that we can actually go to Katrina issues and actually look at the state of Mississippi and its resources, both in terms of area, point, network, and so on, and begin to organize related to that kind of way of operating. When we did a national model with EPA, we actually were able to take the 12,500,000 businesses, position them, and position them throughout the country, and organize it related to life cycle. Who are all the sourcers, the transporters, the processors, the resourcers, at all scales, from county to zip code to state to country. We had 500 of these maps. And so I'm just going quickly through a whole series of things that we've done to show you the possibilities that this could possibly mean in the future. We began to do pattern recognition and begin to look at patterns within this as to directing us in certain ways versus other ways. Projects around the world, we began to get very conscious of taking the ecological footprint technique and using it as a way to gauge what we were doing, but also to understand that this ecological footprint changed drastically in the kinds of places we were working. Afghani with 1.1 acres of life support for all the water, all the air, all the energy, all the materials, etc., compared to our average of 23.7 acres. The U.S. right now is over. That's the deficit, that it's over. So the visualization of these things became very neat to be able to work with that technology. So the U.S. could be summarized. We could summarize China. We could summarize Europe. We could summarize Mexico. Japan was many times over. And so these became very obvious ways of operating. When we got into a gaming environment, it was very interesting that because of the way we're trained, we think very linearly. We do not think of overlaying these footprints. So the idea that you actually could take wastewater and put it into your open space system, and that open space system could perform better in air and oxygen terms via the wastewater, is really not within the thinking of how people conceive even of an eco-sustainable so-called community. And one of the interesting things here is how much overshoot. In other words, how many of these areas you could not fit back onto the playing board because you didn't have the mental capacity and understanding to figure out how to do that from the technology standpoint. So we played with those kinds of things a lot. We actually had an RFID game that you could take position and pieces on the community level. As you're positioning them, you're beginning to see cycles of things beginning to get complete, of food, of water, or energy. It's getting there. How much time do I have?
How about 2 minutes?
Oh, easy. So we could do this at a home scale. We do it at a community scale, possibility of doing it at a national scale. This became a mock-up for students to begin to understand how the Solar Decathlon in Washington, D.C. Mall next round could actually be a large game that we could shift things around. So these 200,000 people that go through that mall were participating in understanding the areas and sizes of things that it takes to support one even within their home and how far over or under they are. We're very interested in making these things fun. I love it when the students are laughing. They said, that's unbelievable, and so on. So I think that's it, believe it or not.
Great, thanks. So we're going to have a conversation now, and I've got a question for you guys. I'm not sure who this is for. I'm wondering how we get from, I mean, this is probably for you, Plenty. I'm wondering how we get from these demos and from visualizations to practical real-world effect. How do we actually implement this in the world, and how do we find ways to respond to something like, I mean, the ecological footprint, for instance. If I look at my ecological footprint and see that I'm consuming 23 worlds, what does that mean to me? How is it relevant? What do I do?
Well, I think there are various ways of looking at it. I think a nonprofit is, in our case, in the business of trying to develop techniques where this begins to really fly on its own accord. So that if we look at our work, you know, the Austin Green Builder Program has now been duplicated in about 30 cities. So the germ has been picked up. So how many buildings and how many millions of dollars worth of business activity is actually happening within that sector? It's interesting. Now, whether they all understand it as a life cycle phenomenon is another question. Maybe the framework is wrong, but the fact is that people are doing it. States are changing.
Okay.
Countries changing.
Don?
I think when you got like really a lot of data like that, it can be extremely relevant, directly relevant to people who have the power to make change at a regional scale. So if you've got people who are doing planning, who are architects, who are actually using that data at a large scale. But for people who are, I mean, if you want to be able to really understand your own footprint, there's really interesting stuff happening in locative technologies, as well as sort of using sensors. I mean, there's a thing just a couple of days ago with people, you know, wearing bike couriers in Cambridge, England, wearing air pollution monitors on their backs, and how that was that kind of swarm of couriers who were there all the time, and they're collecting all that data all the time. They have a individual sense of what's happening where, what's happening in terms of, in that case, air pollution, not ecological footprint. But you got this really direct kind of relationship with the immediate kind of system. You're pulling one of the threads down and making it relevant.
I guess a question for both Jaime and Joel. We talk about serious games, but how seriously do we take serious games? How do we embed these serious games in our lives so that they are part of our day-to-day thinking and not just something that we do on the weekend?
Well, I think it depends on who you're talking about when you say we. People who have direct inputs into planning and strategic choices have some pretty interesting tools. There's the MetroQuest system, which is kind of like a SimCity for actual working planners, and it has the capacity to play out some of the energy and traffic implications. And so these tools are there for actual hands-on application for those subsets of communities that have the wherewithal and the position within the community to be able to apply them. But the bigger story, and for me ultimately the more important story, is the use of these kinds of games and simulations and tools as systems for cultural and cognitive change. I mean, these become devices for changing expectations. You know, changing the language that we use when we talk about the world. You know, the more that we immerse ourselves in these kinds of tools, even if we recognize them only as games, only as play, they do change the kinds of lenses through which we view the kinds of experiences that we have outside of that play. I mean, I don't know how many of you are regular players of SimCity, but I know that every time I go through a game of that, next time I'm out on the street, I'm suddenly thinking in terms of the models and mechanisms of that game. And you see the same kinds of things happening with all sorts of games, actually. You know, whether you're talking about, you know, everything from World of Warcraft to Civilization to, well, hopefully not many of us are, you know, getting too immersed in something like, Battlefield. But the notion here is that these games do change the way you think. And ultimately, you know, I'm a great believer that the key transformations happen from the bottom up, happen because of social change, not because of authoritarian imposition.
Joel, you're kind of an authority on Second Life. Do you see any work with replication of energy systems or that kind of simulation there?
Well, there's a company called Eolus that is trying to create the data standards for smart buildings to talk to virtual worlds so that you can use Second Life as kind of like a surveillance system for the smart buildings that you manage. But I think more importantly, I think Jermaine's right. There's going to be, to answer your other question, there's going to be a multitude of ways that we kind of start to use this information. Right now, kids are playing a lot of Club Penguin and Webkinz, which currently is optimized for casual game and shopping. And in Second Life, one of the top categories is fashion, and one of the top activities people do in Second Life is shop. So there's a lot of interest in shopping, but there is no optimization for what that means in terms of maybe my ecological footprint, my energy footprint, or something like that. I think we need to see what we're going to see are more SimCity kind of environments where people will be able to optimize on things in addition to shopping that are going to have a direct effect in our lives. Now, if this was 30 years ago, the discussion we would be having would be, what kind of film should we make in order to change the masses, right? Yeah. So I think the point is that gaming is something everyone's doing now, especially at a certain age and younger. And it's just another form of media. So what we need to do is participate in the culture through gaming to optimize on things in addition to shopping.
Okay. Jermaine?
Well, I just also want to note that these technologies, these systems will become much more or even more evocative and even more powerful as they move off of the desktop, off of the laptop, and into more personal mobile devices. And you think about, I think Pliny mentioned the concept of the cell phone as the Swiss Army knife. In some respects, the cell phone is the AK-47 of the new era, because it has the potential to be an inherently revolutionary device. And we can see this happening in the world of politics already. We can see it happening in the world of social relations, subcultural relations. Increasingly, it's beginning to happen in the world of sustainability and environmental footprint and our recognition of our impacts. And so, there's an example of a system in Japan that uses a QR code on boxes of produce that lets you walk up, snap a cell phone picture of the QR code on the box, and get back in a matter of moments the entire history of that exact box of lettuce or carrots or whatever. You know, everything from when they were picked, where they were grown, what kinds of fertilizer and pesticides, if any, and what just everything about the history of this particular item, accessible to you through a simple, in most cases, cheap mobile device. And as these kinds of virtual world, as these kinds of augmentation technologies move into the hand, into these small systems, the more they will be real-time accessible and real-time useful for being able to make good on-the-fly decisions.
A question for Pliny. I know that in looking at your building systems and thinking about how to get a kind of zero impact building, you've been considering the kinds of data that you would actually have to gather about a particular site. Could you say a little bit about that, about what kinds of data we would want to factor into the kinds of simulations that we would do to understand the impact?
Well, what we found is that there's a sort of a first level of experiential information that relates to the events around you that you have just interfaced with to say, did I just use as much water as, my neighbor or more or my community at each phase of the life cycle, say, of water. But then lots of people say, all right, what happens if my community were to do this? And so that begins to get into another complexity of things. So the level of complexity has to do with the person's ability to interface or want to interface. And the first level of interface is personal. Is this helping me, number one? Then is it helping my neighbor or it's my family, the neighbor? And there's sort of a hierarchy of personalization that grows out of that to our experience. But it is interesting, as I think back to, the original SimCity, and talking to Will Wright, who I brought into a planning forum many, many years ago, because what he was trying to do is he had two versions. He had one, the professional version, that never got going. The other was sort of the play version. The professional version and the play version interface with each other. So kids in the community and families and so on would come up with hypothetical things. The interface was, how was that working from the extent that a planner could pick up on that information and incorporate it? They were never able to finance the professional version. Just as a sort of a side note, it is interesting that some of these things have gotten to that point. You want to say something?
Oh, yeah. I was going to actually answer a question that kind of came up in the chat, which was, there was somebody who was asking whether the feedback tools are useful really on an individual behavior level. And kind of going back to a little bit of what Jamie was talking about, I mean, we can simulate a lot of stuff, right? You can do that even in building design and doing kind of building information modeling and other things where you're actually looking at prior to the building. You can actually look at prototyping, energy, lots of stuff. You can look at the daylight and how it moves across the building. But ultimately, the issue really comes down to how people use the building once they're in it. You've built it, and then you need to be able to monitor that. And there's a group called Lucid Design that have done amazing work with dashboards once the building is built, which is the key point, which is really when you've got CO2 impacts from the energy use, you can actually look at that and it works really, really well. It's been extremely effective. And what's interesting about that kind of thing is that you can basically scale that up so that you've got buildings that are competing with each other, or cities that are competing with each other, to decrease their impact. But it's like anything. I mean, once you can see what's happening, you've got feedback, it changes your behavior. We know that about a lot of different kinds of technologies.
So one of the challenges in Austin, I think could be met is Austin Energy is going to put wireless meters sometime in the near future, right, on every house, so they don't have to have a meter person read the meter. Well, you've now got that data. Well, you can now aggregate that data by neighborhood, because one of the things we're talking about is you got to have local action to get to the answer of what you're saying, and these tools just are ways to motivate people to action because they're working on real data and they're doing what-if simulations. So Austin Energy, I think, has the potential to actually do what we're saying if they take the data, they aggregate it, like you do on the web, make it available, and so that neighborhoods can see how they're doing and how their neighbors are doing in terms of energy consumption. And I could see where a neighborhood would get together and say, you know what, let's all, we see what our energy is, let's see what would happen if we were all to put solar cells on our roofs, right? And let's go to the city, get that, or go to Solar City or someone to install, and you now have got a feedback mechanism. And I could see competition going on between neighborhoods, schools.
Yeah, it's the same as that Curitiba example.
I think one thing that's really interesting about these visualization tools is, as you describe, what we're talking about is a capacity to represent reality, a capacity to interpret reality, but probably, in some ways, most importantly, a capacity to experiment with reality in a safe and low impact, relatively low impact way.
Yeah.
This is the notion that as we're moving into this kind of, as we are in a really uncertain environment, experimentation and innovation becomes all the more critical. But these are expensive technologies. And it's extremely expensive and risky if you do it wrong. And so the ability to play with it and play both in the sense of enjoyable, non-goal-oriented activity and in the sense of trying something new because it's a chance to try something new really becomes all the more critical in this kind of environment.
Do we have some questions from the audience?
Hi, I'm Robin with Discovery Channel, and we are very interested in this subject matter and how to visualize green. We've recently launched something called Earth Live, which is a 3D interactive of the globe with overlays of erosion of deserts and sea level change. And, we're also plotting kind of what scientists are doing around the world, around the issue of climate change. It's kind of become, right now, how we're doing it is manual. So we're looking for some ways to kind of bring in these massive amounts of data. We have a person that we're working with that's very familiar with NASA and NOAA data, and then trying to take this data and create it in an interactive way. So I'm looking for some advice if you have kind of thoughts on some things that we could do there. And secondly, for Mr. Fisk, are your games just 3D models, or are they, available? Are they online games or flash games, or how are those being presented?
The games so far have not been as much focus as I'd like to have happening at our center, and very little funding has been gained. Probably the changing point was the fact that when we submitted a international sustainability gaming proposal to the U.S. Department of Education, we actually connected five parts of the world virtually as well as experientially. And we gridded each other's sites to the point that we could upload to a satellite and say what activity was successful within this grid and what wasn't, and what happens if it was, can we make a virtual game out of that. There was a tremendous amount of excitement, but the administration decided to cut all FIPSI money, so we lost $750,000. Otherwise, I'd show you one.
As for it's called Live Earth? Earth Live. One question, do you know if it relies on KML format for its overlays? Okay, good. That was the one thing that I think would be the most important, to make sure it fits in with this rapidly developing ecosystem. But I'd be happy to chat offline about that.
Speaking of Will Wright, he gave a great keynote last year where he did a demo of his upcoming game Spore, which is coming out in the fall.
Real soon now.
Yeah, real soon now. Long time in development. And for anyone who's not familiar with it, you basically play with anything from the individual organism evolutionary point of view on up to space colonization. So it's kind of a broad scope. But one of the things he mentioned was, as a game designer, he's always trying to recalibrate human intuition. And he said it's very difficult for humans with a 75-year lifespan, 15 to 20 of which you're in development, to think about things on a 100-year, 500-year, 1,000-year timeline. And I'm wondering if any of you have anything to share of other things or other work you've heard in that area, whether it's starting with kids and getting them to think about things like that indirectly by playing these games or on up.
No, I'm not trying to monopolize the whole thing here, but this is actually an issue that I talk about a lot. I actually even brought it up I was interviewed for Wired yesterday, and it came up in that interview. The notion here is that, or the underlying issue here, is that the human brain evolved to deal with really quick cause and effect and to be able to do rapid pattern recognition of I see we have 10 minutes left here, rapid pattern recognition. And so we need to, and yet we can learn to do things that we haven't evolved to do. And so the recognition that thinking long-term is a trainable skill and is not something that has to come inherently, I think is actually a really important concept, because it gets us over the hump of thinking, well, we can't do it, so we never can do it. You know, the reality is this is something that you can learn to do. And just as a side note, it may be that the whole 75-year lifespan thing is not going to be too much of an issue too much longer. And then the question arises of, well, how does it change our perspective if we know we're going to live for 150, or if Aubrey de Grey is right, a couple thousand years?
The other thing is that looking at sustainability is extremely complex, and it's also something that we're kind of learning to do. I don't know if I know anything about how to teach kids how to do that, but what's interesting about some of the stories I've heard out of the gaming world is sort of how you can kind of model and show complex cause and effect in a really complex system to get people to actually understand systems that are larger than what we were maybe evolved to understand.
There's possibly another way of thinking about your question. This isn't exactly an answer, but there is a new book called Biophilia and the Built Environment. And that is, one of the people in it is E.L. Wilson, whom we all know. But one of the chapters is a chapter on how the brain works that I put in there from the standpoint of the neocortex being more connected to life cycle issues, and the fact that maybe this whole effort in the sustainability field of shrinking the world around us so it speeds up, so that you have all the cycles of nature around you in your building for air and water and food and so on, might be a function actually of the neocortex wanting this as much as it is us crazy greenies thinking that it might be relevant in the world. Just a thought.
Hi there, my name is Ken Eklund, and I'm the creative director of an alternate reality game called World Without Oil. And so I can see some nods up there, some people have heard of it. And so I just see some connections here with kind of what we did with that game and what we're talking about, especially in terms of shaping the future, foreseeing the future, having people play it before they live it. I especially see some tie-ins with the idea of the city as a game, just very exciting, I think, in that regard. And so I kind of wanted the audience just to know about, you know, the visualization effort that we did in that game. Essentially, we just crowdsourced the visual. We pretended that an oil shock was actually happening, and we asked people to send in their reports from the field telling about how $6 gasoline, only sporadically available, was affecting their lives. And it was just a very successful method of collecting a huge amount of really well thought out data with kind of very little effort. I mean, we didn't have a lot of money. So, you know, I guess the message that I'm trying to say, and you can respond to, is just the idea that, you know, some of these problems can be crowdsourced, and we saw that in some of the diagrams that you had. But through the game mechanism, that sort of playing with your future, that's kind of the impetus that really gets people engaged with the game. I guess the last thing I just want to say about World Without Oil is we did get a lot of people saying, this really changed my life to participate in this, you know, 1 month-long experiment, thought experiment, if you want. So
you just ran for a month. It was finite duration. You're not doing anything now.
I only had funds to worldwithoutoil.org. All of the material that people posted is still there. And actually, we are preparing lesson plans for high school teachers so that they can run a little oil crisis in their classroom over a 2-week period. So it is kind of living on.
Also, a quick note that one of the key designers of World Without Oil, Jane McGonigal, is giving the keynote today at 2. I work with her at Institute for the Future. I strongly encourage you to go if you have the chance.
Yeah, I'll second that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I have a comment about that. So it seems to me that the challenge isn't coming up with really compelling experiences that can change people's lives, because we can do that. I think the one of the big challenge is how do we get other people to get their friends and family involved so more people are doing it rather than a certain circle of folks. That's another panel, but that's one of the big challenges.
I think there's a big question of how the personal relates to the larger community. That question comes up a lot. And he was talking about crowdsourcing. I think crowdsourcing offers some answers there. If we could create environments that were broadly used. Another question?
Yes. Don, you mentioned that you had done some work recently on the sustainability of food systems.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little more about that and about how people can contribute to the sustainability of food systems just in their everyday lives and maybe the choices they make. And I'm not, and without knowing at all what your research was about. And also, mm-hmm. something I've read is that, you have a choice in some grocery stores. Do you buy the organic produce from a small farm or do you buy the big factory industrial sort of farming? But I'm wondering about some of the trade-offs. Like I've read that, you know, the factory stuff that comes from a huge farm that gets packed into trucks really tightly and the trucks don't drive as far because it's a really efficient network. And so I'm not sure how I should think about that. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm not going to go too far down the rabbit hole of talking about food systems because it could really consume us. But the project that I was working on was a project called Beeline that actually addressed really the redundancies in the system and exactly what you're talking about, just the fact that trucks are, you know, bringing apples to the Northeast into a really great apple growing region. Those kinds of redundancies have a lot to do with the fact that there's a really fundamental lack of information about what's getting made where and where it's going. And so a lot of what we were doing, I was actually working in the Northwest, first in Vancouver, BC, and then down in Portland with EcoTrust, looking at how we can basically create really visible information. So it was really about kind of visualizing the system and creating an online structure so that farmers can then can sort of say, okay, I've got this many potatoes, this many turnips, this many blueberries, whatever, and put it up on the system and say, okay, we're trying to get all this stuff to go to Vancouver, and then be able to really organize the trucking network so that things are getting picked up and brought to a local region rather than being centralized. Because basically, I mean, I'm from Toronto, and the city of Toronto, there's a giant building that's sort of like the Ontario food system, and everything goes there and then everything leaves there. So, a lot of that actually has to do with information and transparency. But I'm not going to go too far down the rabbit hole about what is better. There's a lot of weighting of decisions of local versus non-local, but local is really, I think Pliny could probably comment further on that because it really connects to what he's talking about and flows in the city.
Well, just a very quick thing. And the New Yorker had an article, I think called Bigfoot, all about food and the life cycle. And it's very interesting what you should not necessarily assume mm-hmm. about food. Mm-hmm. It's a very complex subject. As to distance and all kinds of things.
Yeah, but we can talk afterwards as well.
Adina.
Hi, I'd like to lazy web a need out there, and I'll tell a quick story and then ask for feedback about potential resources. So who here is actually in from the Bay Area? Okay, cool.
We have 1 minute.
Yeah. I live in Menlo Park. There's a potential plan to put a train across the Dunbarton Bridge. I went to there was a presentation from the folks at Caltrain. They described their traffic model, and they talked about how many riders it was going to get, and they used the same number for ridership if the train connected up to the BART or if it didn't. And it turned out that the modeling for this stuff is done by like a very small number of people, like one or two people. There's like one guy named George who works in the basement of the VTA. It's very narrow, concentrated. It's not even accessible to folks like the city council people in the towns. So I think that there's a real unmet need. There have been consumer product. SimCity is, what, 15 years old? That did simulation and modeling, you know, for a really long time, but the professional tools are extremely inaccessible and expensive still. And I'd like to hear any comments or thoughts about how to improve that situation.
I think we're at the end of our time. Do y'all have a quick response?
If you're talking about municipalities, if they have a Freedom of Information Act, I would exercise that, but that's probably only at the state and certainly at the federal level.
Right. But it's not just access to the information, it's access to the planning process, because that is, you know, it takes months to generate a new number.
I think the thing to do is to push for charrette planning processes. If you're familiar with those, they are inclusive of the community, and they're becoming more and more common, and there have actually been several here in Austin. Several urban planning projects in Austin were designed with charrettes. And there's a really good book about charrettes called the Charrette Handbook that gives you all the background you'd need. And there's like a national charrette, is it institute? Anyway, there's an organization, a national organization that helps coordinate those. But you have to get, you know, obviously you have to get the city on board, and you have to get, you know, you have to get all the stakeholders on board. Charrette depends on that.
I don't know whether we have any time, but, you know, it is amazing how there have been some just spectacular ways of getting communities involved with data that are not necessarily all the high-tech things that we keep thinking about, particularly in this conference. I will never forget that when the London County Council hired a really wacky guy by the name of Cedric Price, who was given the job of getting everybody understanding what the London County Council was about to wipe out, whose house, where, what part of the community, where the new streets and the roads and the highways were about to come through. And they would put out flyer after flyer after, you know, TV announcement and helicopter droppings of flyers. Nothing worked. Finally, he said, "Can I have 7 tall buildings?" I said, "Sure, what do you want 7 tall buildings for?" "I want the roof." So he took the roof. He took all these different colors of lights, powerful, and put them all around the roof and simulated the entire land use plan and all the transportation plan for the entire city. And I'll tell you, 4 minutes, the entire city was wondering, what is that blue light coming through my window, and what will it mean? So if you know, it's a feedback thing and participation, you can go too far, good example, but what are all the mechanisms in between that we could be talking about to make that visible?
And that's,
very interesting topic.
I think that's a suitable closing statement. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.